Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday. It's August 14th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Some bad and sad news to tell you about today. Unfortunately, our guest, Nader Sayish, had to go away. He was scheduled to do the show, and I'm actually, I feel bad about it because it was like perfect timing. We were going to talk to him about what was going on in the Middle East because he's got so many connections in the Middle East, so it would have been really fascinating to get his perspective. But hopefully we'll be able to do it at another time, and so I can't wait for him to get involved and engaged in that issue, despite the fact that, you know, basically he spent most of his time here as the assembly member of the 90th District, and we talk about stuff that's local. It's always great when he can give us a perspective from an international perspective, and that's really exciting. So anyway, so I'm sorry about that. We had planned and didn't get a call until very early this morning that he won't be able to make it. So I can't wait till the next time when we can talk to him. Well, the biggest news probably that took place yesterday was that Israel and the United Arab Emirates have normalized relations in an historic Trump-brokered deal. Well, it seems that Israel and the United Arab Emirates have reached a historic peace deal on Thursday that will lead to a full normalization of diplomatic relations between the two Middle Eastern countries in an agreement that U.S. President Donald Trump helped broker. Well, the announcement makes the United Arab Emirates the first Gulf Arab state to do so, and only the third Arab nation to have active diplomatic ties to Israel. Trump tweeted a statement from the countries acknowledging the deal. He then told reporters in the Oval Office that it was, quote, truly a historic moment, end quote. And then he continued, he said, now that the ice has been broken, I expect more Arab and Muslim countries will follow the United Arab Emirates, end quote, he said. Well, Trump said the leaders of Israel and the United Arab Emirates would sign their historic peace accord in the White House in around 3 weeks. The deal grants a rare diplomatic win to Trump ahead of the November election, as his efforts to see an end to the war in Afghanistan have yet to come to fruition, while efforts to bring peace between Israel and the Palestinians have made no headway. For Israel, the announcement comes after years of boasting by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his government enjoys closer ties to Arab nations than publicly acknowledged. Netanyahu has sought to build settlements on lands sought by the Palestinians and embraced a Trump proposal that would allow him to annex larger parts of the large parts, about 30%, of the occupied West Bank, while granting Palestinians limited autonomy in other areas. So Netanyahu said it was a historic day that launched a, quote, new era, end quote, for the Arab world and Israel. For the United Arab Emirates, home to skyscraper-studded Dubai and the rolling oil-rich sand dunes of Abu Dhabi, it further burnishes its international campaign to be seen as a beacon of tolerance in the Middle East despite being governed by autocratic rulers. It also puts the United Arab Emirates out first in a regional recognition race among neighboring Gulf Arab states. United Arab Emirates leader Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan quickly stressed in a tweet that during a call with President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu, an agreement was reached to stop further Israeli annexation of Palestinian territories. However, Netanyahu then said in a national television address that he had only agreed to delay annexations in the occupied West Bank, that the plans remained on the table, and that he would never give up our rights to our land, end quote. Now, for the Palestinians, who long have relied on Arab backing in their struggle for independence, the announcement marks both a win and a setback. While Thursday's deal halts Israeli annexation plans, The Palestinians have repeatedly urged Arab nations and governments not to normalize relations with Israel until a peace agreement establishing an independent Palestinian state is reached. President of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, voiced his, quote, strong rejection and condemnation, end quote, of the deal, called for an emergency meeting of the Arab League. Well, in a statement, Abbas called the deal an aggression, quote, end quote, against the Palestinian people and a, quote, betrayal, end quote, of their cause, including their claim to Jerusalem as a capital of their future state. Hamas, the Islamist group that controls the Gaza Strip, rejected the Israel-United Arab Emirate Pact as a, quote, reward for the Israeli occupation and crimes, end quote, and said it, quote, does not serve the Palestinian people, end quote. A joint statement for the United States, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel was issued immediately after Trump's tweet. It said delegations would meet in the coming weeks to sign deals on direct flights, security, telecommunications, energy, tourism, and healthcare. The two countries also will partner on fighting the coronavirus pandemic. Well, the joint statement of the United States, State of Israel, and the United Arab Emirates reads as follows. President Donald J. Trump, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, and Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi and Deputy Supreme Commander of the United Arab Emirates, spoke today and agreed to the full normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. This historic diplomatic breakthrough will advance peace in the Middle East region and is a testament to the bold diplomacy and vision of the three leaders and the courage of the United Arab Emirates and Israel to chart a new path potential in the region. All three countries face many common challenges and will mutually benefit from today's historic achievements. Delegations from Israel and the United Arab Emirates will meet in the coming weeks to sign bilateral agreements regarding investments, tourism, direct flights, security, telecommunications, technology, energy, healthcare, culture, the environment, the establishment of reciprocal embassies, and other areas of mutual benefit. Opening direct ties between two of the Middle East's most dynamic societies and advanced economies will transform the region by spurring economic growth, enhancing technological innovation, and forging closer people-to-people relations. As a result of the diplomatic breakthrough and at the request of President Trump, with the support of the United Arab Emirates, Israel will suspend declaring sovereignty over areas outlined in the president's vision for peace and focus its efforts now on expanding ties with other countries in the Arab and Muslim world. The United States, Israel, and the United Arab Emirates are confident that additional diplomatic breakthroughs with other nations are possible and will work together to achieve this goal. The United Arab Emirates and Israel will immediately expand and accelerate cooperation regarding the treatment of and the development of a vaccine for the coronavirus. Working together, these efforts will help save Muslim, Jewish, and Christian lives throughout the world. Throughout the region, actually. This normalization of relations and peaceful diplomacy will bring together two of America's most reliable and capable regional partners. Israel and the United Arab Emirates will join with the United States to launch a strategic agenda for the Middle East to expand diplomatic, trade, and security cooperation. Along with the United States, Israel and the United Arab Emirates share a similar outlook regarding the threats and opportunities in the region, as well as a shared commitment to promoting stability through diplomatic engagement, increased economic integration, and closer security coordination. Today's agreement will lead to better lives for the people of the United Arab Emirates, Israel, and the region. The United States and Israel recall with gratitude the appearance of the United Arab Emirates at the White House reception held on January 28, 2020, at which President Trump presented his vision for peace. Their appreciation for United Arab Emirates' related supportive statements. The parties will continue their efforts in this regard to achieve a just, comprehensive, and enduring solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. As set forth in the vision for peace, all Muslims who come in peace may visit and pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and Jerusalem's other holy sites should remain open for peaceful worshippers of all faiths. Prime Minister Netanyahu and Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan expressed their deep appreciation to President Trump for his dedication to peace and in the region and the pragmatic and unique approach he has taken to achieve it. A joint statement from the U.S., United Arab Emirates, and Israel saying they had agreed to the full normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, as we just read. Quote, opening direct ties between the Middle East's most dynamic societies and advanced economies will transform the region by spurring economic growth, enhancing technological innovation, and forging closer people-to-people relations, said the statement by Trump, Netanyahu, and Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the day-to-day ruler of the United Arab Emirates. It said the leaders had a three-way call discussing the deal. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo praised the deal. Quote, this is a remarkable achievement for two of the world's most forward-leaning, technologically advanced states, and reflects their shared regional vision of an economically integrated region, he said in a statement. It also illustrates their commitment to confronting common threats as small but strong nations. He added, quote, blessed are the peacemakers, Mabruk and Mazal Tov. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson also offered warm words. United Arab Emirates and Israel's decision to normalize relations is hugely good news, he wrote on Twitter. It was my profound hope that annexation did not go ahead in the Middle East, and today's agreement to suspend those plans is a welcome step on the road to a more peaceful Middle East, Johnson continued. For his part, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that he hoped the Israel-United Arab Emirates deal can help realize a two-state solution with the Palestinians for peace in the Middle East. Guterres said that annexation would effectively close the door on negotiations between Israeli and Palestinian leaders and, quote, destroy the prospect, end quote, of a viable Palestinian state under a two-state solution. Among Arab nations, only Egypt and Jordan have active diplomatic ties with Israel. Egypt made a peace deal with Israel in 1979, followed by Jordan in 1994. Mauritania recognized Israel in 1999, but later ended relations in 2009 over the Israel war in Gaza at the time. In addition to Trump, the main U.S. mediators for agreement were the president's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, special Middle East envoy, Avi Berkowitz, and David Friedman, the U.S. ambassador to Israel. The United Arab Emirates is a U.S.-allied federation of seven sheikdoms on the Arabian Peninsula. Formed in 1971, the country, like other Arab nations at the time, did not recognize Israel over its occupation of land home to the Palestinians. Arab oil is not dearer than Arab blood, the United Arab Emirates founding ruler Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan once pronounced when agreeing to an oil boycott over U.S. military support to Israel in the 1973 Middle East War. Well, the United Arab Emirates relied on white-collar Palestinians in creating its nation. Over time, it maintained its stance that Israel allowed the creation of a Palestinian state on land it seized in the 1967 war. But in recent years, ties between Gulf Arab nations and Israel have quietly grown, in part over their shared enmity of Iran and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. President Mohammed also shares Israel's distrust of Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and the militant group Hamas that holds the Gaza Strip. Iran's Tasnim news agency, which is affiliated to the country's elite revolutionary guards, denounced Thursday's deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates on as shameful. It remains unclear what prompted Israel and the United Arab Emirates to make the announcement now. In June, the United Arab Emirates ambassador to the United States warned in an Israeli newspaper op-ed that Israel's planned annexation or annexing the Jordan Valley and other parts of the occupied West Bank would, quote, upend, end quote, Israel's efforts to improve ties with Arab nations. The agreement gives Netanyahu a domestic boost at a time when Israel's shaky coalition government is plagued by infighting and facing the possibility of early elections in the coming months. Netanyahu has seen his popularity plummet as the country grappled with a renewed coronavirus outbreak and skyrocketing unemployment as a result of earlier lockdown measures. Netanyahu also delivered a valuable diplomatic achievement to his good friend Trump ahead of U.S. elections. Still, by dropping the annexation plan, Netanyahu may be hedging his bets ahead of a possible change in the White House. Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, has made clear that he would oppose any moves by Israel to unilaterally redraw the Middle East map and annex lands sought by the Palestinians. Netanyahu also raised criticism inside his own hardline Likud party, whose members strongly supported annexation. Netanyahu appears to be betting that Likud members and the small but influential settler movement will agree the peace agreement delivers more benefits than unilateral annexation. Opinion polls have shown that annexation is not a high priority for the vast majority of the Israeli public. Abandoning its annexation plan changes little on the ground. Israel already holds overall control of the West Bank and continues to expand its settlements there while granting the Palestinian autonomy in a series of disconnected enclaves. And some 500,000 Israelis now live in the rapidly expanding West Bank settlements. Next year, Israel will take part in the United Arab Emirates' delayed Expo 2020, the World's Fair being hosted by Dubai. A secret synagogue also draws practicing Jews in Dubai. The United Arab Emirates also has announced plans to build the Abrahamic Family House in Abu Dhabi, which will house a mosque, a church, and a synagogue. Israelis traveling with Western passports routinely enter the United Arab Emirates without a problem, which I did as well. Though one still can't make a phone call between the two countries, Israelis also work in Dubai's gold and diamond trade as well. Emirati officials also have allowed Israeli officials to visit, and the Israeli national anthem was played after an athlete won gold in an Abu Dhabi judo tournament. Israel also has a small mission representing its interest at the International Renewable Energy Agency in Abu Dhabi. My God, a huge, huge story if ever there was one. one second. So that's on one part of the boundaries there. And so let's see what else is going on. Let's move over to Lebanon. We'll go back to Israel right after. Lebanon's military is getting sweeping new powers amid anger over the Beirut explosion. Now, Lebanon's parliament on Thursday approved a state of emergency in Beirut in its first session since a catastrophic August 4 explosion granting the military sweeping powers amid rising popular anger at official corruption and mismanagement and political uncertainty. The government resigned after the blast that killed more than 170 people, injured at least 6,000, and wrecked the capital's port and caused widespread damage across the capital. The disaster has raised popular fury toward Lebanon's leaders to a new level as the country reels from an unprecedented economic and financial crisis along with the coronavirus pandemic. Before it resigned, the government declared the state of emergency that gave the military the power to declare curfews, prevent public gatherings, and censor the media, as well as refer civilians to military tribunals for alleged security breaches. The action required approval by lawmakers, which they granted on Thursday. The move has been criticized by rights groups and others who say that the civilian government already was operating with increased powers because of the coronavirus outbreak. Some pointed to the military crackdown on protesters last week, fearing the extended powers could lead to silencing dissent. Parliament met outside its regular location to observe social distancing amid a surge of coronavirus cases and because of nearby ongoing protests by those who want the entire political class to step down. Well, the session opened with a moment of silence for those killed in the blast. It then moved to discuss the resignation of nearly a dozen lawmakers last week to protest the government's handling of the blast. A major Christian party bloc is boycotting the session. It still was not known what caused the fire responsible for igniting nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate that was stored for years in Beirut's port, but documentations have emerged that show the country's top leadership and security officials were aware of the stockpile. After the government resigned on Monday, the cabinet is in a caretaker capacity. It was not immediately clear if Parliament had technically extended the government decision on the state of emergency for 15 days or simply imposed it to take effect starting on Thursday, said rights lawyer Nizar Sahieh. There is incredible chaos, Sahieh said. He said that the state of emergency justification is to extend the power of the state and security agencies and, quote, control the opposition, end quote. Quote, we're waiting for the army to help the reconstruction, not to be an extension of power, he said. Lawmaker Simon Abi Ramiye protested that Parliament had convened to vote on the state of emergency while it was already in effect and called instead for forming a parliamentary committee to investigate the explosion. We are living in a state of institutional blunder, he said. We are in a place and the Lebanese people are somewhere else. The public wants to know the truth behind the negligence that led to the explosion. Lebanon's political landscape has been shaken by the events. Before resigning, the caretaker prime minister proposed early elections, an idea that was not supported by the parliament speaker and other political groups. Since the resignation, there has been a flurry of closed-door meetings and political haggling to form a government that meets the approval of domestic and international powers. Lebanon's complicated sectarian-based political system requires the prime minister to be chosen from among Sunni Muslims. It wasn't clear if there would be a national unity government, which would mean the participation of all political parties, or an emergency transition government. France's defense minister was due to arrive in Beirut on Thursday amid a flurry of foreign visits to the stricken country. France has been leading efforts to help Lebanon emerge from the drastic blow, including talks to political parties to hasten the formation of a new government. And also on Thursday, U.S. Undersecretary for Political Affairs David Hale was due to arrive in Lebanon for a two-day visit. Hale is expected to, quote, reiterate the American government's commitment to assist the Lebanese people in recovering from the tragedy and rebuilding their lives, a statement by the U.S. Embassy said. He will also stress the, quote, urgent need for enhancing and embracing fundamental reforms. So very, very unbelievable news, which is coming to be. Now, this is very interesting because very close by, France is going to bolster the Mediterranean military presence it has over the Turkish gas exploration, which is in disputed waters. France will increase its military presence in the eastern Mediterranean, President Emmanuel Macron said on Wednesday, calling on Turkey to halt oil and gas exploration in disputed waters, an act that has heightened tensions with Greece. The French leader voiced concern over, quote, unilateral, end quote, exploration by Turkey in a call with Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. Macron's office said in a statement, it added that prospecting should, quote, cease in order to allow a peaceful dialogue, end quote, between the neighboring NATO members. Now, the standoff deepened this week with the arrival of Turkish seismic research vessel Uruk Vice in a disputed area of the Mediterranean occupied by warships. French Armed Forces Ministry said on Thursday that France will send two Rafale fighter jets and the naval frigate Lafayette to the eastern Mediterranean as part of plans to increase its military presence in the region. Country will temporarily reinforce its military presence, Macron's statement said, to, quote, monitor the situation in the region and mark its determination to uphold international law. Well, Greece's prime minister warmly thanked France on Thursday for its pledge to boost its military presence in the eastern Mediterranean. Mitsotakis tweeted that Macron is, quote, a true friend of Greece and also a fervent protector of European values and international law. Turkey and Greece are at loggerheads over competing claims to natural gas reserves, brought into sharp focus by the attempts of European Union members Cyprus to explore for gas in the eastern Mediterranean over Turkey's strong objections. Macron called last month for European Union sanctions against Turkey and for what he described as violations of Greek and Cypriot sovereignty over their territorial waters. Relations between Paris and Ankara have also frayed over the conflict in Libya. Macron called last month for European Union sanctions against Turkey for what he described as, quote, violations, end quote, of Greek and Cypriot sovereignty over their international waters. Relations between Paris and Ankara also have frayed over the conflict in Libya. Erdogan spoke by phone on Thursday with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and European Union Council President Charles Michel to discuss the situation in the eastern Mediterranean. President Erdogan reiterated his commitment to defend Turkey's rights against attempts to disregard them. Erdogan's office said of the call with Michel one day before European Union foreign ministers are due to discuss the latest developments. Later on Wednesday, Erdogan said that he would discuss the issue with German Chancellor Angela Merkel and President of the European Council Charles Michel in an attempt to defuse tensions. Erdogan told a meeting of the ruling party's provincial leaders that he wanted to resolve the emerging crisis, quote, through dialogue and negotiations, end quote, accusing Athens of harboring, quote, ill will, end quote. We have always sought a solution to problems with Greece at the table. We don't want to infringe on others' rights, but we won't allow another country to infringe upon ours, he said. Well, this comes after tensions flared between Greece and Turkey in late July, after Erdogan provoked worldwide outrage with his controversial move to transform Istanbul's Hagia Sophia, formerly a Christian Greek Orthodox church and later a museum, into a mosque. Unbelievable. So that's one of the stuff that's going on, which is important. Now, bear with me a second here. And let's move over to Gaza. Israeli airstrikes are targeting Hamas positions in Gaza over their use of incendiary balloons. Fresh Israeli airstrikes hit Hamas's targets in the Gaza Strip on Friday. Today, Israel Army said, as a week of hostilities between the Jewish state and the Palestinian enclave raged on. Israel says the strikes and other measures, including halting the territory's fuel supply, are in retaliation for firebombs suspended from balloons that float over the border from Gaza. The overnight attack on sites used by Hamas, the Islamist group that rules the enclave, was the fifth such operation this week. It came just hours after Israel and the United Arab Emirates agreed to normalize ties in a landmark U.S. brokered deal. And that agreement has been strongly rejected by the Palestinians, who called it a, quote, betrayal, end quote, of their cause, including their claim to Jerusalem as the capital of their future state. Well, Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, said Hamas aerial defense post, that a Hamas aerial defense post, observation post, and underground infrastructure had been hit on Friday and did not report any casualties. Over the last week, explosives and arson balloons have been launched from the Gaza Strip into Israeli territory, it said in a statement. In response, a short while ago, IDF fighter jets, attack helicopters, and tanks struck a number of Hamas military targets in the Gaza Strip. A similar attack the previous night caused no reported casualties, but left an unexploded missile inside a UN-run school compound in a Gaza refugee camp. Well, dozens of blazes have been reported this week in southern Israel as makeshift firebombs attached to bunches of balloons or kites set agricultural fields and scrubland alight. In response, Israel has closed its cargo crossing with Gaza and also reduced the territory's permitted coastal fishing zone. Hamas on Thursday condemned Israel's attacks on Gaza and its sanctions as dangerous and aggressive behavior, warning of consequences the Jewish state will bear. Hamas and Israel have fought three wars since 2008, and despite a truce last year backed by the United Nations, Egypt, and Qatar, the two sides clashed sporadically with rockets, mortar fire, or incendiary balloons. The Gaza Strip has a population of 2 million people. More than half of them live in poverty, according to the World Bank. Palestinian analysts say the fire from Gaza often aims to pressure Israel to give the green light with a transfer of Qatari financial aid into the Strip. On Monday, Hamas fired several rockets into the area, into the sea, as a warning message to Israel, a source close to the Islamist movement told Agence France-Presse. So, that's what's heading out there. Now, let's move on, because there's so much more that is happening on the world stage. And this is interesting, again, religious divisions are being revealed in India. Evidently, a human chain is protecting Hindu temple amid riots over a Facebook post. Riots broke out in Bangalore, India, on August 11 after a legislator's relative allegedly posted a derogatory statement about the Prophet Muhammad on Facebook. The crowd of people gathered outside the politician's house, stormed two local police stations, and set fire to vehicles in the area. Among the vehicles, community youth formed a community youth formed a human chain to protect a Hindu temple near the riots, fearing the mob would damage the place of worship. Well, the night of August 11 in Bangalore was marked by arson and mob violence after a mainly Muslim crowd descended on the DJ Hali police station, demanding the investigation of a Facebook post published by the nephew of a member of the Legislative Assembly, the MLA, his name, Ahanda Srinivas Murthy. The post, now deleted, allegedly insulted the Prophet Muhammad and was published with what some have called, quote, an intention to create violence, end quote. And when police investigated or hesitated to investigate violence, the mob grew angrier, leading to a night of destruction. The mob was evidently furious. Photos and videos posted on social media show a massive crowd of people descending on the police station in northeast Bangalore, the capital of the southern Indian state of Karnataka. So this is interesting, and this happens in Bangalore. Let's just see. No, it doesn't show what's going on there. And then here's the scene in which a mob is trying to break into the police station, and that's about it. Okay, well, so there's no audio for you on that. Anyway, student journalist Noor Zahira went to the police station at the beginning of the conflict. The mob was really furious because a few weeks ago a similar situation had happened, but it was not an inflammatory post against any faith or any religion. It was against a legislator. And the editors noticed that in June, a man was arrested for posting highly derogatory, objectionable comments about an Indian chief minister. And within minutes, the police had gone to the accused home. So people were really saying, if you can take swift action against a person's post, why can't you do that if it's a religious post? Well, MLA Murthy has said that he is not in touch with his nephew, identified as P. Naveen Kumar, who shared the post. Meanwhile, Kumar claims that his account was hacked when the post was published. And police have since arrested Kumar. But after officers failed to immediately take action, thousands of Muslims gathered outside the gates and the police station in protest. So fearing that the growing mob would damage Hindu places like of worship in the Muslim-majority neighborhood, a group of youth volunteers began to gather around a nearby Hindu temple. So that's the story there. Okay, let me move back. Some other issues that you might find interesting. Bear with me a moment here. One second. All right, I want to move over to this is a video. It talks of to the uncertainty which surrounds Israel's West Bank plans after the United Arab Emirates deal. This is from Franz Van Katt. So listen in to this. We'll get a better understanding of what's going on here. One moment. Okay. Barbara should be able to see this in a moment. Okay.
The United Arab Emirates and Israel have agreed to normalize ties in a landmark deal brokered by the United States. Now, the two sides will be signing the agreement at the White House in the coming weeks. The UAE is the third Arab country to establish formal diplomatic ties with Israel. The Palestinian leadership, meanwhile, has rejected the deal, saying it signifies a betrayal to their cause. For more on this story, we can bring in our chief foreign editor, Rob Parsons. Rob, why has the United Arab Emirates agreed to this deal?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, first of all, this is a really big deal for the United Arab Emirates to take this step, to become only the third Arab state to do this, and effectively, you know, smash whatever unity was left in the Arab world and its position towards Israel. It really is a huge, huge step. Having said that, however, there's no doubt that in one sense, this only puts formality to a relationship which pretty much existed in any case, although nobody spoke openly about it. I think the key issues probably for the United Arab Emirates were Iran, shared concern with Israel and also Saudi Arabia, of course, on the position of Iran, the prospect that doing a deal with Israel would open the doors to closer ties with the United States, in particular the supply of weaponry, sophisticated weaponry that it couldn't get its hands on so long as it didn't recognize Israel. But also, you know, the question of the annexation. This was at the heart of, I think, of United Emirates' decision to go ahead with this. They were pretty concerned, like with Saudi Arabia, that if annexation went ahead, it wouldn't just be the end of the possible two-state deal that everybody was hankered for so long to the Palestinians. It would bring chaos, violence to the Middle East again. I think it wanted to back away from that. So what it gets from this deal, I think, what the Israelis are calling suspension, but what in reality must surely be an end to the prospect of annexation. You know, the Israelis are not going to pull out of this deal if it means jeopardizing this deal with the United Arab Emirates and the prospect further down the road of other Arab states recognizing Israel as well. Bahrain, for instance, seems to be quite a possibility. But, the icing on the cake would clearly be recognition by Saudi Arabia. Israel knows 100% that if it pulls out of this deal and annexes the West Bank, any deal with Saudi Arabia would be thrown out. A possible deal with Saudi Arabia would go out of the window. Plus, there's the pressure from the United States as well. Israel would not annex the West Bank without the go-ahead from the United States. So the chances, I think, of Israel backing out of this deal are pretty slim. And the United Arab Emirates must recognize that as well. So, you know, for them, although this has come with a lot of opprobrium from some members of the Arab world, and obviously from the Palestinians, the criticism from Turkey and from Iran as well, of course, you know, the positives that come out of this clearly outweigh the negatives.
And very quickly, Rob, what's in it for the U.S. President Donald Trump?
Well, you know, this isn't the peace deal of the century, obviously, but that was slipping out of his grasp in any case. You know, there was so much opposition to annexation around the world, and in particular, of course, in the Arab world, and Saudi Arabia in particular. You know, the Americans have been wanting to edge away from that in any case. You know, it's not the big deal that Donald Trump has wanted, but it does give him a diplomatic feather in his cap just before the election. Will it be decisive in any way? I suspect not. Will it play well to his base? Yes, of course it will. You know, and for Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, of course, this is a big, big triumph. He's going through really difficult times at the moment with the reaction to the failure of the Israeli government to deal competently with the coronavirus really weighing on Israeli society at the moment. You know, this makes him look good. And, you know, this is just months before he goes on trial on corruption charges. He needs something positive, and he's got it with this. You know, for Israel, you know, to achieve a breakthrough with another Arab state on this without making any concessions to the Palestinians on two-state is for him and for Israel a pretty big move.
Historic in itself. Rob, thank you very much for that. Rob Parsons reporting that.
Okay. So let's just move back and look at something else. One moment. So much is going on. Let's find a little bit more about the strongman from the United Arab Emirates, MBZ, as he's very well known. So, one second. All right, let's just get a review of him. So MBZ is the United Arab Emirates strongman behind the historic deal with Israel. Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan is the first Gulf leader to break a deal normalizing relations with Israel, has long been seen as a strongman who has driven the United Arab Emirates' rise to diplomatic prominence. A trained soldier and football fan, Sheikh Mohammed has for years been the quiet power behind the throne of Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates. In a 2009 note to U.S. President Barack Obama leaked by WikiLeaks, former American Ambassador Richard Olson said the royal, better known as MBZ, was the man who runs the United Arab Emirates. Despite a low profile and his apparent reluctance to speak in public, his ambition has been on display in recent years as the United Arab Emirates built its profile as a regional player. The country, a collection of emirates, better known for its skyscrapers, palm-shaped islands, and opulent mega-attractions, has in short order built a nuclear power program and sent a man to space. And in July, it joined another elite club by sending a probe to Mars to mark the 50th anniversary of its unification. Named Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi in November of 2004, Sheikh Mohammed is the third son of Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, the revered founder of the United Arab Emirates. With his brother Sheikh Khalifa, the nation's president, he served as deputy commander of the armed forces and chairman of the Executive Council of Abu Dhabi, which controls the Emirates' substantial finances. Now, while the glitzier Emirate of Dubai has had to develop its tourism and services industry to make its fortune, Abu Dhabi sits on a 90% of the United Arab Oil Emirates production. Born in the capital on March 11 of 1961, Sheikh Mohammed was seen, was sent to a military school in Britain, where he graduated from the famed Sandhurst Royal Military Academy in 1979. He rapidly rose to the ranks of the armed forces to become Air Force Commander, Deputy Chief of Staff, and finally Chief of Staff in January of 1993, and a year later was promoted to the rank of General. Described by diplomats as Abu Dhabi's strongman, Sheikh Mohammed has forged links in world capitals, particularly in the West. He is widely believed to have taken the decision to deploy boots on the ground in Yemen in 2015 as part of a Saudi-led military campaign against Iran-backed Shiite Houthi rebels. The Yemen war marked the first protracted military campaign abroad for the United Arab Emirates and the first time it had to contend with military casualties, with dozens of Emirati soldiers killed. The coalition has been denounced for airstrikes, including on markets and hospitals, that have caused heavy civilian casualties since intervening in Yemen in March of 2015. of the United Arab Emirates, which largely exited the conflict last year, has also been accused of running secret prisons across the southern part of Yemen, and yet it denies the accusation. Well, although the Crown Prince does not often speak in public, he left the November 2017 inaugural speech of the Louvre Abu Dhabi to Dubai ruler Mohammed bin Salman, or Zayed, sorry, and he left the November 2017 inaugural speech of the Louvre Abu Dhabi to Dubai ruler at that time, Mohammed bin Rashid. His reach into the political sphere cannot be underestimated. Under his leadership, Abu Dhabi has fostered trade and political ties across the region, including to a limited extent with Shiite Iran, but has sided with the United States against Tehran's nuclear program and with Saudi Arabia on its role in the mainly Sunni Arab world. Sheikh Mohammed also took the lead on a staunch, no-mercy domestic security policy. Observers believe it was he who masterminded an unprecedented clampdown on Islamists in the United Arab Emirates, with dozens handed lengthy jail terms over years of ties to extremists. For the United Arab Emirates, a reputation of tolerance, a contrast with its conservative neighbors. 2017, he announced that Abu Dhabi's Grand Mosque, also known as Sheikh Zayed Mosque, after his father, would change names to become the Mariam Isa, or Mary Mother of Jesus Mosque, as a means to consolidate bonds of humanity between followers of different religions. Well, an avid football star, MBZ, is president of the local club in the Oasis of Al Ain, his father's hometown and the second largest city in Abu Dhabi. He has also been spotted cycling through the capital in shorts and a helmet. A keen hunter and a poetry enthusiast, he's married to fellow royal Sheikha Salama bint Hamdan Al Nahyan. The couple has four sons and five daughters. Big family. Okay, so that's one of the issues there. Let's quickly go back, see what else is happening around the world, which you may find interesting. Bear with me a second here. All right, let me just see here what else is happening. And this is interesting with regard to the Middle East again. Netanyahu is thanking Egypt, Oman, Bahrain for their support of the United Arab Emirate deal. So Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Friday thanked the leaders of Egypt, Oman, and Bahrain for their support of the agreement to normalize ties with the United Arab Emirates. So while Israeli newspapers overwhelmingly welcomed the accord, Palestinian media condemned the triple aggression against Palestinian rights, referring to the Jewish state, the Emirates, and the deals brokered, the United States. So in the West Bank city of Nablus, protesters set ablaze posters of the leaders of the three countries. Netanyahu, for his part, thanked Arab supporters on the nomination. And I think that I'm also, I didn't realize it's already 11 o'clock, and I don't know. Well, that's the story there. Just want to see if there are other issues close to the home that we can talk to you about, and no, I think that's it. Actually, going back to Beirut, though, this is going to be interesting because evidently Beirut's Karantina district talks to the devastation and the old tensions that have surfaced. So let's look at this in a moment and see what this has to say. Okay. It's about 2 minutes long. One moment.
We're in the Beirut neighborhood of Karantina, a poor neighborhood close to the port, so one that's been decimated by the explosion. And here, families simply queue for food.
I don't know what's inside it, oil, lard, sugar, a bit of everything. My friend and I took the last boxes. He's from Deir al-Zor. I'm from Raqqa in Syria.
The humanitarian crisis has shone fresh light on the decades-old tensions between Lebanese and Syrians.
Our own government destroys it, and our spaces we have to help strangers live comfortably. A house is destroyed, nothing is left. I live just over there, now my kids and I are in the street. What can I do?
It is long before this Syrian woman is ushered out of the area by a security guard. Meanwhile, another Syrian is questioned about her right to receive aid.
They took our names and numbers, but they never told us. Where are you living, love? Here in Karantina. Where exactly in Karantina? By the mosque. What can I say? We are the people of Karantina. We're suffering too. Okay, we've lost lives.
No country has taken in more Syrian refugees than Lebanon, but in this time of crisis, local NGOs are looking inward.
We try to give to everyone, Lebanese and Syrians, she says, but first of all, this aid is for the Christians of Ashrafiya.
Whatever the tensions, one thing is clear. The Syrian community has been hit hard in this crisis, at least 43 Syrians losing their lives, and now many, many more helping with the cleanup of Beirut.
Wow. Always something goes on around the world. Unbelievable. Okay. Well, let's quickly see what else is going on in the world stage. Bear with me a moment here. See what's happening here. A little closer to home. Okay. One second here. Where are we? Oh, here it is. With Biden and Harris launching their campaign with a promise to rebuild, as they call it, broken America. So listen to this report. One second. All right. Okay, bear with me a moment.
In her campaign trail debut as Joe Biden's historic pick for vice president, Kamala Harris didn't waste any time before taking swings at the Democrats' opponents in the White House.
America is crying out for leadership. Yet we have a president who cares more about himself than the people who elected him. A president who is making every challenge we face even more difficult to solve.
Speaking at a high school in Delaware, the pair blasted Donald Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic
Harris blaming the number of American deaths on Trump's refusal to, quote, take it seriously. The California senator also encouraged the Black Lives Matter movement and promised to bring the country closer together if elected. Harris being the first Black woman to appear on a major party's presidential ticket, Biden said her story would inspire the country.
As a child of immigrants, she knows personally how immigrant families enrich our country, as well as the challenges of what it means to grow up Black and Indian American in the United States of America.
Wednesday's joint appearance comes days before Biden will formally accept the Democratic presidential nomination at next week's party convention. If elected president, he would be the oldest person to take office, and there is broad speculation that he'd serve one term and prepare his deputy to take over the top job.
Yep. So that's the story there. Well expressed. And let me just quickly look and see what else is happening on the world stage. And just take one other thing, which I think might be interesting. One second. This is very, very interesting, and I don't know if you've heard about this, but evidently there's an effort to power from an artificial sun. It's called a fusion reactor project, which aims to provide clean energy. Listen to this report. Bear with me a moment. One second. It's the biggest science project in human history. That's what's being touted as. One second.
Direction 3X leveraged ETFs.
Okay.
All trades on China.
All right, so we're going to find this out in a moment. There we are.
Bring in Gavin Yamey, who's Professor of Global Health at Duke University. Gavin, rather than asking about masks, I'd like to start by asking you about the long-term effects of this disease, because we're talking about a second wave coming, but there are some people who have had it, seemingly recovered officially, but they're still very much suffering from symptoms that appear to be dragging on and don't appear to want to end.
Yes, that's right. So thanks for having me back on your program. I've just written a column for Time magazine with my colleague, Dr. Sharon Taylor, a consultant, adolescent and child psychiatrist. And we point out that we tend to think of COVID-19, this illness, as having just two forms. And that's wrong. We tend to think, well, people could get very sick quite quickly, perhaps, you know, get hospitalized, go to the intensive care unit, and in the worst case scenario, die. Or we tend to think, well, it's very mild, maybe like a cold or flu. You have it for a few days and you get better. We have been asleep at the wheel in recognizing a third form. It's become known as long COVID, and that is when people get infected and their symptoms don't go away. They persist for weeks or even months, and it can be a very debilitating, very disabling condition with all sorts of symptoms from chest pains and palpitations to breathlessness, intense fatigue. And our piece really raises the alarm. These are patients who I think have been largely forgotten. They are in the shadows. We haven't done well in the medical community, in the public health community, to recognize the suffering of this group. And it could be, according to research, it could be that as many as 10 to 15% of people who get infected with the new coronavirus go on to have this long-term condition.
What you just described is something that my own wife is actually going through right now, Gavin. So this is actually quite timely that you and I are speaking, and we're speaking about something that interests many, many people. What advice do you have to someone who's going through what you've just described?
Yes, well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your wife. I have to say one of the reasons I got into this issue and started to research it with Dr. Taylor is that we know so many people, friends, colleagues, you know, other doctors who have these long-term symptoms. And I would say a couple of things. First of all, too often I think doctors have not really recognized this illness. I think recognition is the first step. We've heard too many patients tell us that, you know, doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals kind of brush off patients with these long-term symptoms. Maybe they label them as anxious or something like that. You know, doctors themselves right now are under a lot of pressure. There's high rates of burnout. And there hasn't been, to be fair, a lot of information about how you treat this condition. I would say the second thing is that all patients with this condition deserve treatment and rehabilitation. And there is growing research, and there are some specialists out there who have now been laying out treatment guidelines. And certainly, there are a couple of things that are really important. First of all, if you've got persistent symptoms that are lasting for months, you really do need to see a specialist in rehabilitation. And that specialist will do tests of your heart function, your lung function, and then go on to prescribe a very sort of individualized prescription of rehabilitation. Maybe it is heart and lung rehab, physical therapy, other forms of rehab. If your symptoms are less severe, in primary care, we know that family doctors can interact with other specialists. You know, heart specialists, lung specialists, physical therapists, which should really be interdisciplinary care that people are receiving, and increasingly care that stretches across different sectors. We know that in many parts of the world, people with long COVID are suffering economic consequences as well. So they, you know, there are trials of bringing financial advisors into the team as well. So it should be multidisciplinary. There should be rehabilitation specialists. If people have persistent symptoms, they really do need to have a proper evaluation and a proper prescription. And then the last thing we are desperately calling for, Dr. Taylor and I, is for research. There has been so little research on long COVID. We really need to understand, you know, how common is it? How do you diagnose it? How do you treat it better? We need to be doing trials. We need to be testing out, you know, new treatments. And that could be done in specialized long COVID clinics.
Professor Gavin Yamy of Professor of Global Health at Duke University. I was taking very, very clear notes there. Thank you, sir, very much indeed for bringing shedding light on this idea of long COVID and how many people are suffering and the medical profession not yet, as Professor Yamy said, being asleep at the wheel in many ways as to how people are still suffering because of this virus. Let's move on now.
Okay, so... Bear with me a moment here, because this is another view. Okay. All right. This segment's called The New Normal.
Bringing you reports from around the world thanks to our network of France 24 correspondents. This week we are taking you to Cancun, Mexico, Venezuela and Kenya, home to Africa's largest urban slum. But first to Lebanon, where Beirut is still struggling to cope with the aftermath of the explosion that tore through what was once known as the Paris of the Middle East. Decades of widespread corruption of sectarian tensions have damaged public services. The people are saying enough is enough. The Lebanese are taking matters into their own hands, as Nadia Massi, Abdellah Malkawi, and Karim Yayawi witnessed in Beirut.
Near Beirut port, a once bustling neighborhood, devastated. No building here is untouched. The human cost, far worse. Locals keep busy organizing food parcels, while NGOs hand out essentials to those left with nothing.
They give us diapers and other important things to the house.
The absence of the state is painfully obvious. No politicians have toured these streets. The cleanup led entirely by volunteers.
If we don't do it, who will? There's no state, and there is simply no state.
Few issues exemplify the collapse of the Lebanese state quite like electricity. Since the end of the civil
companies, private companies, have stepped up to fill the gap, making big profits off the absence of state electricity.
I'm preparing two generators today, sir, so that there can be light in the night. State's providing no electricity here at night at the moment.
Facing the skeleton of the silo, a volunteer HQ. Architects and engineers among those offering their services for free, checking which homes are too dangerous to live in. Others simply don hard hats and head out into the streets.
We are the state, we are the government of the civilians, and we will build the country that you want. We don't expect anything of them, we just want them gone.
Help is coming for Lebanon. Over 250 million euros pledged, but with deep distrust, not just of the country's current leaders, but the entire political system, there is real concern that the money won't reach those most in need.
Now to Kenya, which has one of the highest rates for teenage pregnancies in the world. And COVID-19 isn't helping, quite the opposite. Schools are shut until January, meaning the girls cannot get the usual help and advice from their teachers. All of this report from Bastien Renouille and Elodie Cousin in Kenya.
16-year-old Elizabeth has not gone to school since March, when the government closed all schools to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Like many other teenagers here, she spent her days looking for money on the streets. She offered sex to a boy for money and is now 3 months pregnant.
When I ask my parents for money, they always refuse. They are stripped, she says. When I needed to buy something for myself, I would go see a certain man and have sex with him for money, she says.
Alone and afraid, Elizabeth turned to her teacher for help. Even though classes stopped, Jane Mbula opened her doors to give her students advice.
I was afraid to tell my parents. I thought they would kick me out of the house. I asked my teacher to help, and she did.
In recent years, Kenya stepped up efforts to curb teenage pregnancy, which accounts for 8% of births. Before the pandemic, schools helped with prevention.
When we are them at school, at least we are helping them. Because they have very little time outside there to interact with people. When they go to school, you have homework to do, you have ABCD to do, so you are busy.
At the moment, help comes only from charities. This one distributes sanitary towels to teenagers and offers advice on sexuality.
I think the most important thing that they're lacking is someone to guide them, someone to talk to, someone for them to talk to, someone to be able to direct them between good and bad in the midst of all this confusion that Corona has brought.
The charity helps young people earn money by hiring them to help with sanitation. Kenya's president has called on government agencies to find solutions to the increase in teenage pregnancy.
On the other side of the Atlantic, the situation is worrying, with the United States, the Caribbean, and South America representing more than half of COVID-19 cases worldwide. Crippled by international sanctions, Venezuela's economy is further weakened by the pandemic. Our correspondent in Caracas met with citizens trying to make ends meet by putting their various skills at good use.
Unable to work during the lockdown period, Maria Leonor and her neighbors have turned their homes into small, informal stores. Residents in this middle-class suburban area sell basic necessities like dry goods, vegetables, and eggs to pay their bills.
Our neighbors are really welcomed and helped us, and they agreed to everything. Our prices aren't too high because we understand the situation. And as long as they need to eat, they'll be able to sell and have enough money to survive.
Angela Lugo is buying her weekly stock of vegetables a few houses down. She sees the burgeoning neighborhood business as a win-win. Elderly residents like herself can stay closer to home with less exposure to the virus, while passing on some much-needed cash to those who
the first time people are out of work and they need to find a way to survive. So everyone's opened their own small business. There's no other work, she says. They have to do what they can, so we're helping each other.
Atelio Gastidis is an out-of-work waiter who set up a makeshift barbershop in his building. He misses his old job and barely earns enough to buy food.
This continues going to be difficult, very difficult, because we're dying of hunger. So we'll either die from hunger or from the pandemic, one or the other. I don't know what else to do, he says.
Venezuela's economy has been stuck in recession for 7 years, but its population has struggled to adapt and stay afloat. With formal employment already hard to find, the coronavirus pandemic is sending more and more workers into the shadows.
In the U.S., chefs and restaurant owners have been urging President Donald Trump to act quick and strong to help save the industry in these times of coronavirus. In Washington, the Brasserie La Liberté is one of many examples of restaurants staying open even though they're losing money every day. Measures of social distancing are easy to implement, given that customers have not returned in large numbers. Take a listen to the chef at La Liberté, who's rather pessimistic.
You feel like a small restaurant, you see 20 to 40 people, all of a sudden you can only see 18 at most. And how are you going to pay the rent, pay the bills off of that? It's awesome. Every day you hear about new closures. And I really do think that by the end of this year, definitely in D.C., if not the whole United States, 50% of restaurants will shut down.
At this time of year, business should be thriving in Cancun, with visitors flocking to enjoy the nightlife and the beautiful beaches. It's one of Mexico's tourist hotspots, but the coronavirus pandemic has ruined the season, casting a shadow over the future of many entrepreneurs. Here's a report by Laurence Cuvillier in Cancun.
Long stretches of white sandy beaches and crystal clear waters. That's what the Riviera Maya is all about. But lately, tourists have found they can't have that anymore.
Yo intenté recorrer aquí esta parte, tomarme la foto aquí donde dice Cancún, y el policía no me cedió el paso.
Beaches have been closed in Cancun to limit the spread of coronavirus. You may dip your toes in turquoise water only if you book a luxury resort, which has its own private beach. For the other hotels, bankruptcy is looming. More than 60 have been listed for sale recently. Hernan built his 5 years ago. Now he has to let it go.
Claro, el precio COVID-19, como decimos. Sí. En este momento es una propiedad que el precio es de $1,250,000 y cuando el precio normal, en un normal sería de $1,850,000.
His realtor, Roberto, has 20 hotels in his listing in the area. Almost none own a private beach. Here in Tulum, only one stretch of the shore has remained open to the public. And there it is, covered in sargassum, a fast-growing type of seaweed which has become a yearly nightmare in the Caribbean. Beachfront hotels sometimes dump their smelly mounts here to clean their own beaches.
Plus, the fun of it in the area says on property. The market has suffered a blow because of the decline in transactions. There are also some great deals for those who are so eager to buy.
According to Roberto, the Riviera Maya's economic future has just changed path. Its target isn't short-term visitors anymore. Now it's all about a new category, long-term residents, which the expansion of home office has just created.
That brings us to the end of our show. I leave you with pictures from Europe, starting here in France, where face masks are now mandatory on busy streets of major cities like Marseille or Paris. Other countries are doing the same, including the Netherlands, in Amsterdam's famous red light district. Thank you all for watching. Take care and see you soon.
project is going to be exploited, and the scale of this exploitation will only grow.
We have a beautiful planet, and it's protected, and we can use space exploration to better understand it.
We've moved from that wheel to what do we do, right?
Join us on Down to Earth, where we explore the incredibly complex relationship between humans and our planet. We're here to ask the tough questions and find answers that may just surprise you.
Down to Earth on France 24 and France24.com.
All right, I guess that's about it. So we're going to stop the end of this here, and we're going to just have wish you a great day. And what we're going to do is we're going to, so we'll just wish you a great weekend. And let me just quickly tell you who we have scheduled for Monday. I know that we're going to speak to John Bailey, the White Plains Net Reporter publisher. And we're also going to speak to Michael Edelman, the political analyst and pundit. And let me just see, what else do we have? No, those are the two. And then we'll cover some other international news at the time as well. So I guess that's it. Wish you a great weekend. Thanks for being with us. And all the best. Take care. Goodbye.